coming to you from the City of the Weird. Exploring topics from the esoteric and unexplored to dimensions unknown. Shining a light of truth on the darkest corners of our reality. Welcome to the Curious Realm. Well, hello, everybody, and Happy New Year from the Curious Realm. Thank you so much for tuning in tonight. We have a great episode for you. In the second part, after a quick commercial break, we will be joined by our good friend and guest, Dr. John Hall. We will be talking about updates in the world of targeting technologies, targeted individuals, things that are going on in the halls of Congress to hopefully help targeted individuals, especially when it comes to things like Havana syndrome, things like that. In our first segment, we are happy to be joined by our friend Nathaniel Gillis. He is the author of A Moment Called Man. We will be talking about the world of demonic body snatchers, a race of beings that has been around since, well, probably before the dawn of man, who basically possess us, take over our bodies, and use us by a means by which to procreate. It's a pretty fascinating research, Nathaniel, and I love talking with you about it. Welcome back to the show. How have you been, my friend?
It's been very good, brother. It's good to be back with you. You're one of my favorites in the field, so it's an honor to be back with you.
Same. And, you know, I just want you to know, Google loves the term demonic body snatcher, by the way. It's an SEO-friendly one. So, hot tip.
That's what it's all about, my friend. Yeah, what a wild subject matter, no doubt.
Well, it's fascinating. And, you know, as somebody who has had experiences with shadow people to the point of physical contact in my life, as someone who talks about dimensional science, as someone who talks about esoteric learnings, things like the Keys of Solomon, that kind of stuff, mm-hmm. Jinn, the study of this fascinates me because, of course, a lot of people akin shadow people and the occurrence of that to incubus, succubus, these traditional mm-hmm. concepts of nighttime demons that come along, the old hag who comes and sits on your chest, tries to steal your breath. That is not what this is, correct?
Correct. These seem to be archetypes of a singular intelligence. And I believe that it's almost like that allegory, I should say, where it's like, okay, the one man's grabbing the foot of the elephant, the other one's grabbing the trunk of the elephant. They're all grabbing the same animal. They just don't realize it. And so it's almost like these are various ingredients of a singular recipe. And it took me a while to get to that point. But now that I'm here, it's incumbent upon me to create new vocabulary so that we could actually discuss this model of the phenomenon without falling into a linguistic trap. And that's what often happens. Like, how do I even explain that? How do I describe that? Is there a word for that particular phenomenon? And so that's what I've been doing as of late, trying to create a new syllabus for us.
Well, and that is essential. That is a conversation that I have had, that I literally had at the Remote Viewing Association, not only in my speech, but with them after. And with other people in the world of cryptozoology, in the world of parapsychological research, do we have a nomenclature that is viable worldwide, that's a cognate, like the word no? Like most languages you go to, unless it's a very guttural dialect, something like that. Vietnamese, for an example, possibly even African dialects. The word no means no. Means no in German. Means no, they're all pretty close cognates to each other. And trying to find that kind of nomenclature that when you say something, it means the same thing in Italian, so that an Italian researcher understands the same concept. You know, when you speak to somebody in Japan, that kind of like science. That's one of the reasons why science and music and things like that excel globally, is because there's a nomenclature that's used amongst people that transitions the language barrier.
Yes, yes. And the phenomenon is kind of pushing us in that direction. And I think that if necronetics will contribute anything to the field, like I said, it will give us a new language system, because the phenomenon is kind of transcending paranormal parlance now. And for us to even encapsulate some of these case studies in our thoughts, we have to have working vocabulary. And so that's why I've come up with different terms: necronetics, ectomancy, which is the combination of ectoplasm and necromancy, which is, we'll kind of get to that later maybe,
okay.
But that's really what I'm trying to do. And I don't want to think that it's just me changing terms or creating new terms. This is an entirely new field of research.
It is.
And it's a field that I think others all across the world, experiencers, researchers alike, we've been dipping our toes into this ocean. We just didn't know what it was. And so that's really what the Skin That Crawls is going to be about. And then my second book in the series is going to be called Larva, Possession and Pregnancy. It's where I kind of really break that down. But yeah, so that's really my end game at this point in my career, creating a new field of research that will hopefully attract people from the scientific method and from the esoteric field alike.
Well, absolutely, because that combination of the two, I think, as we speak about regularly on the show, Nathaniel, is rapidly approaching. The idea that quantum entanglement, a concept that has basically been taught for millennia through psychic studies, other esoteric studies, things like that. The idea that we can manipulate the world around us, that we are an integral part of that atomic field. Whenever you get into alchemy and that kind of stuff, you know, it's not just the search within with alchemy, but it's also your connection to the world around you in that atomic way. And that esoteric knowledge like that, you have, in the last episode that we had you on, there was an aha moment. And I remember you sending me the picture of my face when it happened. And that aha moment was the idea that, and I want to tie it to what you just said a moment ago, Nathaniel, the idea of this singular intelligence, the idea that not just are all of these instances connected, but they may be motivated by the same intelligence, all of the possessions, even all of the possessions through time. And the idea of this entity, whatever it is, whatever they are, because once again, it's the idea that they are using us as a brood, as a brooding pool to come and possess us, breed and produce another. That they're basically using a form of black magic, sigils, things like 100%. That. You know, once again, the concepts from things like, the Seals of Solomon, stuff like that.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's not a bug in the phenomenon. It's a feature. Mm-hmm. And there seems to be this implemented partnership between us and it. This is why people like Diana Walsh Pasuka and other researchers in the field consider UFO sightings to be initiatory practices where the phenomenon vets you, and it's almost like it incarnates in order to help others kind of materialize their giftings. And so this is what, it's so fascinating when you get into ritual magic, even not just ritual magic, but even if you get back into like church and Christianity, there are some people that just have a knack for it. They have giftedness. You can have one person that can fulfill the ritual 10 times. Nothing happens. You can have a novice show up, do it once, and something manifests. And so it's almost like right now, modernity, the field of ufology is just now catching up with demonology, in the sense that we knew that thousands of years ago. We call them practitioners. And so with Diana Walsh-Posuka's interview, or one of her interviews, she articulates that, where it's like, yes, it's not just UFOs appearing. It's not just, okay, they're manifesting to you in your home. It's literally trying to authenticate something within the individual. And these are initiatory practices. They have been forever.
Well, and that's fascinating, the idea of it being an initiatory practice. Now, I'm a big fan of the work of Dr. Stephen Greer. Let me predicate my statement before we get into it, that this is something that my audience has heard me say numerous times, and something that I have said so many times that I have it down rote, Nathaniel. And that is the fact of when it comes to Bigfoot, I believe that there is a actual hominid species roaming the woods of North America and beyond. However, I believe when it comes to Bigfoot and portals, when it comes to things like that, that there is something else there that is fully willing to use the trope of our minds to manifest itself in a comfortable way. Because if you saw its true dimensional form, what have you, its true spiritual form, it would frighten you. You would go away. However, you're out in the woods hunting a Sasquatch, or you're out on a paranormal investigation, or you're out at a CE5 event and inviting these things, it will gladly use the trope of your mind as its means of entry and its point of egress. You're giving it agency at that point. It's no different than putting a welcome mat out and trying to keep Dracula away. You've said welcome. He's welcome now.
You become the mortal portal, and within this initiatory partnership, it's almost like the phenomenon, and this is going to be very Jungian, but the phenomenon weaponizes archetypes from the collective unconscious.
Yeah.
So what that means is, right, and this gets back into phenomenology, but what do you believe in? And do you believe in Jesus? Okay, then it will incarnate as Jesus. And I started realizing that behavioral pattern when I realized, like, okay, even the Yeshua, Jesus that manifests, it's not a historical figure. It's literally a projection of the individual's belief system. And it's often tailored according to their own literacy. And so it's not the, you know, the first century Yeshua, that's not what's being manifested. It's whatever that individual believes that man to be.
Yeah.
And so that in itself is the archetype that the phenomenon wears as a veil when it's in our presence. And this is what's so fascinating is when we act like, even with the demonic, my friend, we apply rules to the mask, to the archetype, not realizing that it's scapegoating. It's kind of skirting our awarenesses. And we don't really know what's wearing that mask until it's often too late.
Well, we have to ask ourselves, number one, are they playing by the same rules that we are bound by? Because, they're a different being to begin with. And you know, whether you want to accept it as a Lucifer, what have you, the example that I give is Job, the story of Job in the Bible, where even the devil, even the devil still has agency in heaven. He just pops up in the middle of the heavenly court. Poof. Hey, what's going on, guys? Oh, y'all checking out Job? Yeah, he's a wild guy, isn't he? Let me have a crack at him.
Right.
And God's like, Job ain't gonna crack. Tell you what, you can do anything but kill him. Or at first it was, you can do anything but harm him.
Right.
Can do anything but harm Job. So killed his family, killed his crop, killed his livestock, ruined his land, all kinds of things, put him in debt, all kinds of things. Did Job still love God? So hey man, it's not like you gave me free agency. Like, you put in a couple rules in there. All right, well, you can't kill him then. Like, the rules change suddenly. And Job is unawares the whole time of this set of rules that's being played out against him on the other spiritual side, that
absolutely,
he can't stop. He can't stop. The only thing that, of course, stops it is his faith in God. His faith in God never fails. Well, he shakes his fist at God eventually, and he's like, who are you? What do you mean? And he gets humble, and God brings it all back to him. However, the story there is that Job was completely unawares of the situation. And nothing that Job could have done would have stopped that.
Right. There were conversations that were above his pay grade.
Yeah.
Couldn't do it. They existed. They were occurring. He just wasn't aware of it. And I think that's kind of where I'm at in my research is like, okay, what, if any, rules does this proto-intelligence abide by? What can it not do? You know, if we take into consideration what it can do, it's alarming. You know, and I've said this before, where it can create physiological constructs. I mean, if you take parapsychology, for example, it took us 30 years, not us, I'm not a parapsychologist, but it took that field like 30 years to realize that they were chasing apparitions. They weren't realizing, like they weren't understanding that the apparition was a projection of the orb, in orb. And it was only then that they started capturing, setting both cameras up and capturing the orb as it was projecting the apparition. So what I'm suggesting here, ladies and gentlemen, is that we've created an entire field about the apparition, surrounding the apparition, not about the orb that's projecting it. Hmm. We've said those are separate phenomena. And so now we it's fascinating. It's almost like we apply rules we think that apparition follows. But that's not the one we need to apply the rules to. We need to start applying the rules to the orb that's projecting the apparition.
Hmm.
What is that? And that's when you get into epiphenomena where it's like, okay, you're in a pool of water and we're measuring the ripples. We're not measuring the force that displaced the water itself. And I think that hopefully Necronetics will add to that too. But yeah, I think that's where we're at right now is we're starting to realize that there's something beyond the incarnations, beyond the incantations, beyond even the rules we think they follow. And that's what I'm after.
Well, and you know, it's interesting because when you start looking at specifically the modern alien phenomenon, and I am not saying once again that all alien abductions, all alien experiences, things like that are in this realm. I believe that there are alien species and that there are alien craft and things like that. However, I believe that there is also a realm of these things that are in the spiritual that will gladly use that trope to accomplish something. And when you look at specifically the ceremony that was performed by Aleister Crowley that progenerated the entity Lamb, that was right at the beginning of this UFO phenomenon in the world. And it's very interesting how the figure of Lamb and the facial features and things like that oh so closely line up
absolutely
with Gray Alien.
Absolutely.
And it's really interesting. And the whole idea behind that ceremony, Nathaniel, the whole idea of trying to open a dimensional portal. Mm-hmm. And there's a bunch of people out there, and I will address this right now. Some of my audience knows, much of my audience knows, I am a recovering Catholic. I'm a former Catholic seminarian. I'm a fourth degree Knight of Columbus, things like that. However, a lot of things get blown out by headlines, man. And right now there is a jubilee year going on with the Catholic Church. Mm-hmm. Every 25 years, and there's a major ceremony going on where they're opening 5 portals. Okay. The portals are literally doors on the side of a church, people, that are ceremonially bricked up and a metal box put inside with a key to open the door. Okay. These are in various basilicas and holy relic spots, things like that around Rome. This ceremony has been going on for quite a long time. It's nothing new. Mm-hmm. Happens every 25 years. It's No crazy mystical thing, okay? Nobody's trying to open a portal to another dimension. None of that is happening. That's not what this is, okay? It's not like the ceremony for Lamb, okay? Which was very specifically done to do such things, you know?
Right.
Which was very specifically done to open a dimensional portal, to contact demonic entity, to bring them into this world for uses. Because Crowley specifically followed a lot of the magic that is in Solomon's seals.
Yes.
Which of course, as legend goes with the Clavicle of Solomon, that knowledge was divinely bestowed upon him by God to bind the jinn and the demons to his will. Mm-hmm. Basically to give him the power of God over these creatures, mm-hmm. be they elemental, what have you. So, that was the path that Crowley was on, and he was using that to manifest these beings and these entities into being. And it's fascinating to me that your work, Nathaniel, goes beyond that and reaches further into the past to show how these creatures have been around, and that they, as opposed to Lamb, who required Crowley to bring him in, mm-hmm. these things are actively using the magic themselves on us.
Yes. Yes. I think that has kind of set my research apart in the field.
Yeah.
And it wasn't without a cost, you know. It kind of alienated me, no pun intended, alienated me from some of my
contemporaries.
You know, the people like, yeah, because, you know, where do we place Nathaniel? Is he a ufologist? Is he a demonologist? What is it? Yeah. But at some point, we talked about this in the green room, at some point I had to grow out of the dogma and grow into the data. Yes, it's not just that we have practitioners right in among us, right next to us, but some of these beings are sorcerers. That's the only working framework I have for them is, you know, they're performing ritual magic on victims. Hmm. I mean, in a lot of what we have inherited as a species have come from them. I mean, even if we look at the golem in Prague, right, they create this figure and then carve their own sigils into it. And then somehow matter merges with memory and consciousness takes its very first breaths. And then you look at that, that's okay. What's the Hebrew word golem mean? Like, what is it? It means infant. It means infant. And so it's like, okay, what were they actually trying to explain to us? It was, and you know, you get into that, you get into missing fetus syndrome. That's a whole other show, my friend.
Yeah.
But again, this is not a bug. This is a feature, and it's something that transcends the whole field at this point. I mean, like right now, what I'm going to be trying to do here in the next portion of my career is go into houses and specifically find cases that mirror this phenomenon. It's going to be dangerous, but I believe they're still performing ritual magic, not just in the abduction phenomenon, but in the incubi cases as well. And so this, again, it's cross-cultural, it's religious.
Yeah.
But my point here is that whatever they are, we need to have a working vocabulary for it. We may not know the ins and outs of that species, but number one, we have corroborating evidence, what's called pattern confirming evidence. Number one, they exist. Number two, their sorcery transcends all known magic right now. And number three, we're witnessing it in ufology.
The ufology part is fascinating to me because once again, I love the work of Dr. Stephen Greer. I mm-hmm. find some of the things, and I have the CE5 app. I know numerous people that go to CE5 sessions, and I'm not saying that they are practicing any kind of demonic protocol, Nathaniel. Not mm-hmm. whatsoever, because that is not their intent, okay? Mm-hmm. Not their intent. Not their intent whatsoever. However, you can lean on the testimony of our good friend, Mr. Earl Gray, mm-hmm. who was in a CE5 session when that night his abduction scenario happened, you know, and that wasn't a fun experience for him at the beginning, you know, things like that. So it's one of those, He was looking for a entity of light and enlightenment and take me and, mm-hmm. you know, valiant Thor, let's go learn the good things about the universe. And that is not what happened to him, you know, something else that he didn't want happened to him. Now, granted, the alien contact still happened, but the way in which that it's kind of that, once again, that djinn aspect of, I want 1,000 pounds of gold, mm-hmm. and it falls out of the sky and lands on you.
Yes.
You know,
this intent thing is bugging me. You know what I mean? I mean, let's go back and say this. Like right now, the phenomenon is trying to kind of redefine its own nature in our eyes. Long before ufology even existed, John Dee and Edward Kelly were performing magic, ritual magic, specifically Edward Kelly. Number one, they were scrying. In the middle of one of their scrying sessions, there was a ball of light that appeared. It was like kind of a disc, but it was a ball of light surrounding it. And there were little men staring at them from the inside. That erupted from ritual magic.
Interesting.
They were scrying. Okay, scrying. Now, with Professor Esther Amore's research behind me, she has a book called Women's Divination in Biblical Literature. She details the rite of scrying, where it originated in Mesopotamia, and some of the beings that came forward from that ritual. So let's take that in consideration. And then we're going to go into the Russian Academy of Sciences with the Kozyrov mirror, where they essentially took sheet metal, wrapped it within itself, and then even sometimes they would put glass inside, other times they wouldn't.
Yeah.
But the researchers would become practitioners in order to gain technological advancement. This is fascinating. And so they were essentially scrying. And in one case study, these researchers were performing these rituals and going through all this fascinating stuff. Long story short, they see not just UFOs, they see symbols that started manifesting. Sometimes it would manifest in a mirror. Other times it was it was like a result of them in their mind. It would kind of erupt in their mind and their brain. Anyways, at one point, my friend, they witnessed one of these lamb beings.
Interesting.
Manifesting and staring at them as they were focusing their consciousness on the Kozyrov mirror. At the end of one session, okay, so we have lamb there, we have scrying, just like Roderick Kelly and John Dee. But in the finality of it all, they end their session for the night. They walk outside and the security guard pulls them aside and says, "What have you been doing in that building?" And they said, "Why?" They said, "Because a silver metallic object has been hovering over it for the last couple of hours."
Whoa.
So here again, we have ritual magic tied to lamb scrying ufology. So here's the problem. Is ufology even ufology at all? Or is it just, again, us seeing an aspect of this intelligence and creating a whole field around it, saying, okay, that's all there is to it?
Yeah.
There's not. There's much more to this tree. And if we want to study the tree, we don't study the branches. We study the roots.
That's right. That's right. And the mycology around it and everything else.
Yes.
You know, the fungus that keeps it healthy, all that kind of stuff, and the whole ecosystem that is required for a tree to grow. And, you know, one of the things that we talk about regularly on the show, Nathaniel, is the concept of normalization, the concept of these ideas being normalized in society. And an example of that, especially when it comes to magic, with the CK, classical magic, scrying, things like that. I hold in my hand a scrying ball.
Yeah.
It's a sphere of black obsidian. Frequently black mirrors were used. I mean, crystal balls are used as well, all kinds of things. This thing sits on my shelf of esoteria over my right shoulder that you don't get to see, folks. But it's covered at all times. It's covered.
Mm-hmm.
I do not allow it to be uncovered, much like when I sleep, my cell phone, the black mirror that it is face down when I sleep. And there used to be a very common concept before the turn of the century. We used to have things like home burial, that kind of stuff, before the movement of the modern funerary movement, things like that, Nathaniel. And it was very common practice for people not only to wear their black and everything, but to veil mirrors during that time, to keep the spiritual world out, to keep the spirit of the departed from maybe trying to come back, things like that, you know, from trying to return to the world of their loved ones. Like, no, go to the light. You know, don't look in the mirror from the other side of the dimension and wantonly want to be here. So they would be veiled, things like that. But also because of your grief and because of your want of that relative, it was also because of the fact of other spirits may guise themselves in that relative.
There we go. There we go. You hit the nail on the head, brother. And I think that's a part of the phenomenon people don't really discuss. You know, the implications are terrifying for our species. If that is not Dear and Edna, then it knows when Dear and Edna died. It mm-hmm. knows how she died. And in some cases, it knows the clothes she died in. And so this is what's always fascinated me. It's not just that we are creating some of the archetypes it's manifesting as, but sometimes that intelligence will wear that archetype. I am Dear and Edna, but then it'll also incorporate stuff about Dear and Edna we didn't even know.
Yeah.
So it's pulling, it's not just us creating the mask, it's also pulling information from the ether to construct itself in our presence. And it's just like, you know, the Philip experiment where they create this ghost with a fictitious history. And so, right, they created that entity. And then during a seance, it manifests, but it coupled all of the fictitious history with foreknowledge.
Yeah.
To where it called out a lady and says, a young lady, yeah, I noticed that your car is tore up. It's totaled. You got a car wreck on the way to the seance tonight. Isn't that correct? And she's like, oh, my God. Right. So now it's like it has to be Philip. This is deep. Yeah. Has to be Philip because it knows things nobody else would otherwise know. And so this is where I get into ectomancy and topomancy, where tolpa is not just the thought form. That's what we thought it to be. No, it's the entity forming the thought that then becomes a thought form. So it's literally the incarnation of something in the ether that needs consciousness in order to spawn into this reality. It's the observer effect. I'm present, but I can't be me unless you watch me. And so in some ways, the phenomenon is creating witnesses. And it's a little tangent there, but yes. So I'm always fascinated by that concept where it's like, okay, where are they getting the information from?
Yeah.
And it's one thing to know a little bit, at least the information we give it, but sometimes when it transcends that microcosm, I'm left stunned.
Well, never forget, and give me just a second. On occasion, I get up from my seat on camera, but this is one of those occasions because I'll pull over to this cabinet and grab something. Mm-hmm. My copy of the Roman Ritual. Let's get into that real quick and talk about some of the characteristics of the possessed, folks, because it is fascinating. Signs of possession are the following. Isn't it interesting how I have it marked right there, Nathaniel?
That's awesome.
Ability to speak with some facility in a strange tongue or to understand it when spoken by another. The faculty of divulging future and hidden events. Display of powers which are beyond the subject's age and natural condition. And various other indications which, when taken together as a whole, pile up the evidence. But that important one there is the faculty of divulging future and hidden events. Right. Faculty of much like whenever Father Damien Karras goes to visit Reagan for the first time and the demon says, Pazuzu says, you know, your mother's in here with us, Karras. And he asked the mom, like, does Reagan know that my mother died? Like, because his priest friend had told the mom, but the mom hadn't told Reagan. So the demon was aware of these things, and that's just it. Once again, to refer this conversation back to 10, 15 minutes ago, they are playing by a different set of rules. They're allowed to know this information. Same way that Satan was allowed to know this information in the book of Job. This was directly translated to us, folks. He knew how to get to Job. He knew what would push Job's buttons. You know, he didn't just randomly pick at things until it happened. He knew precisely what to do, you know? That stands to be said.
It does. And I think sometimes because of the amount of propaganda in the field of the paranormal, the phenomenon has a lot of free room to manifest.
Yep.
You know, I was on with another host of the show a while ago, and he told me a story that he's talking about how he was at an investigation. He said it was a haunting, a malevolent haunting, and they didn't know what to do. Whatever this was scratching people, attacking people.
Yep.
It was absolutely demonic. And so they called an exorcist one and pulled out a vial of holy water, put it in there, and the entity siphoned the holy water right in front of their eyes. At what point do we start questioning the rules we were told?
That's right.
They follow. And that's where I'm at right now. And I'm having conversations with people online. And I'm just, you look at this, even with Father Malachi Martin, people want to suggest that he just died in his sleep, or, you know, I've heard all kinds of things, but no.
I believe he was gripped by evil. I believe he was gripped by evil at the end.
Of course, he was in his study, reaching for a book on a ladder. In his own words, a shadow figure came by, kicked the stairs from underneath, and he falls, hits his temple on the table. Right? People want to ignore that because it doesn't fit the theological narrative. Right? Well, it can't be the case. It's like, well, at some point, again, going back to our cool phrase, right? We've got to abandon the dog and look at the data. The data suggests that whatever we're looking at has been manipulating religion sometimes to actually imply that they do A, B, and C. They can't do C, D, and E. You know, but it's not the case. Whatever we're dealing with transcends a lot of dogma.
Yeah.
And we need to grow into that data.
Yeah. And quite literally, that is what led to my separation from church. Nathaniel, was the day that I took my experience of a shadow being touching me and grabbing me and climbing on top of me, to my spiritual director. And they were like, well, we don't really have a teaching on that, Chris. And I'm like, so you tell me that there are dark things and dark entities stalking my soul around every corner and that I need to go to church and make sure to have my grace quotient up. But, and I should accept the spiritual with spectral evidence. But when provided evidence of the spectral, there is no spiritual founding to it.
Right.
And that was a leap of logic that I was no longer able to make, Nathaniel, inside of my faith, because my faith is my faith, period. My faith is unshaking. It does not move. It is what it is because of the experiences that have happened to me. However, when the dogma has no answer,
right,
I have to just go with my faith now and not the dogma anymore, you know, because obviously you have no answer. Dogma. And that was disturbing to me, that it was just so brazenly pushed aside in the fact of, because once again, you know, but when you join the seminary, places like that, they tell you, like, you will be an extra juicy target, you know, be prepared to be spiritually bound by things, to be spiritually hunted by things, stuff like that. Because you have chosen a very particular path, and it's interesting.
A dark and sinister one. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's when you become a targeted individual, if there's ever been a targeted individual. Yeah. But, you know, it's fascinating again, when I witnessed the phenomenon trying to use revisionist history against us, I kind of catch it and I notice it, I mark it and I write it down in my notes. And so later on, and, you know, 2 or 3 years later, I go back to them and I start to see these behavioral patterns. We need to have a background of phenomenology.
Yeah.
Even in the occult, at least the knowledge of it, to understand fully the width and breadth of what's occurring in ufology. When we have people like Chris Bledsoe and other people who, even Tim Taylor, quoted to Chris Bledsoe, told him, listen, you know, I just got the phone with Chris and said, okay, hey, what do you say? In his words, it was, I've been contacted by the others. It's time to move into the next stage. You are now to go into churches and to lay hands on people. Okay. That's a behavioral pattern. Number two, when we're looking at Malachi Martin, one day he had just finished up an exorcism. He goes back to his personal quarters. He goes to bed. In the middle of the night, he sees three or four, I think it was three shadow figures standing next to each other. And in unison, they're saying the Lord's Prayer backwards. What was that? It took me years to even come to the knowledge of what they were doing, right? But to the layman, they wouldn't understand it. They would not, they would have no concept of what those entities were referencing. It wasn't until I got into the Kabbalistic exorcistic rituals when you have Isaac Luria, who in order to cast the demon out, would pray the prayer forward and backward.
Mm.
And so what Malachi Martin had done was at first blush, they manifested. He says the Lord's Prayer forward. They reversed it and began to say it in unison. I got chills because what they were doing was essentially reversing the curse. Yeah. In my fear here, guys, now you got me on a rant, brother. Nope. Not hey. You.
No, this no, is just, go.
Well, my fear is if we do not have that head knowledge, we do not have the historical context to even understand what the phenomenon is doing, then we'll think it's all ufology.
That in and of itself breaks the rules, Nathaniel.
Of course it does.
The idea that like that they could even put the Lord's name in their mouth forward or backward.
Yeah.
Breaks the rules that so many are, quote, familiar with.
Yes, you know? There was a war. An absolute war was occurring in Malachi Martin's room.
Yeah.
And so this is what I mean when, okay, the act of laying on of hands, what was that before ufology stole it from us? Oh, that was a rite of exorcism. It was either to cast a spirit in or to pluck a spirit out. So then let's place it in the context now. What are we doing? Why is it that that's the next stage to go into a church and lay hands on people? I thought that's the pastor's job. What are we looking at? And I think, again, this is the fruit, the secondary consequence of this phenomenon trying to revise history in our eyes. And here's the problem. If it can remove the case studies, if it can say that was not me, that was Patricia.
Yeah.
The reference to split, then it doesn't have to give account for all of the negative experiences. And so this is why I believe it's exactly what it's doing. All of the altars, all of the sacrifice, all of the rituals, all of the prayers, and sometimes even the worship, right? Well, if you want the orbs to give us more of an incarnation and manifestation, you've got to tell them how thankful you are. You've got to tell them how beautiful they are,
yeah.
How wonderful they are. And by doing that, it somehow empowers more of an incarnation in our midst. So what I'm looking at actively is the phenomenon recreating its own mythology. Has all the trappings of everything we've seen and known in phenomenology. But now it's ufology. And I go back to my original point. Is Edward Kelly and John Dee. They saw a UFO, but they didn't know that as ufology. They didn't even know it as extraterrestrial. They were performing ritual magic. And so ufology is just a secondary consequence of what was known first as sorcery. And that has to be said. That cannot be ignored.
Yeah.
Because that would be falling into the hand of this proto-intelligence.
Well, and I would say, I would caveat that with at least a percentage of it. You know, because once again, that would go to say that all of them are like that. And I would definitely say that we have interesting samples of things that are not of this world. Elements that don't occur here, things like that. So, that's, absolutely. That is fascinating. And the idea, once again, even of these creatures, that you're talking about being interdimensional, what have you, fully possible, because that is exactly what they were doing in the lamb ritual was
yes.
opening a dimensional doorway between two places. That was the actual ritual, was to open a door to another dimensional plane, and lamb is what stepped out.
Yes.
And 100%. to the point of, those rituals actively happened and everything, at Central Park West, folks, just so you know, the whole story of Ghostbusters is actually based on this ritual and this series of rituals. It's pretty fascinating, but that series of rituals actively happened at Central Park West in New York. And it's interesting to even see that connection, but more interesting to see the connections between, once again, many things in the world of ufology, many things in the world of cryptozoology, that once again are a pretty modern phenomena as far as sightings go. Even whenever you start talking about things like Dogman and stuff like that. These creatures that are out there that we're still wondering about, it's interesting to run down, because once again, it's the study of phenomenology and what these things have in common amongst them.
Right.
So yeah, it's fascinating to me, man, the research that you've done. Now, when it comes to, let's get into ectomancy for a minute. In the last 15 minutes or so, let's kind of explore this idea of, especially because, I mean, the whole reason that I bring up the Black Mirror concept is because Black Mirrors were something that were once just a limited knowledge thing, stuff like that. But hey, everybody's sleeping with a Black Mirror in their room. If you got a TV, if you got a phone, things like that. So, you're literally staring at it all day long, giving it agency, right. giving it. Some sort of consent, to peer into your world and peer into your life. So, the idea of ectomancy and everybody kind of taking part in this without ever even realizing it.
Yes. And I was in a discussion with another researcher the other day, and, one of the more intimate connections between esotericism and the phenomenon is the technology that they are giving practitioners. And so one of the earliest concepts in demonology was that, yes, of course they're giving us technology, but there was a form of incarnation built in to the technology they're giving to us. And so it would be John Keel's Trojan horse in the sense that, oh my God, here's a technological advancement. No, that was essentially a portal. In fact, Nikolai Kozyrov, the actual Russian engineer that came out with the Kozyrov mirror, at the very end of his life, he came around saying, hey, listen, whatever this is, it's a portal. In fact, it's even more fascinating to me. The researchers in the Russian Academy of Sciences that took on his design and actually implemented in their experiments, they came away saying, after they were done with all of their experiments, they came away saying that they were afraid that their government, the military industrial complex, would have weaponized whatever that was. And through the weaponization of that ritualistic technology, that would be a portal. And so they would think it's a weapon. The government would, right? Oh my God, we're going to go to war. We got this new weapon. And their point was, that's not a weapon. That's a portal. You're not projecting something from that weapon. Something's coming through it.
Yeah.
And it's a complete, it's a contrast here. But so ectomancy, again, that's kind of a term I'm trying to create. Hopefully it catches, because
I
was stuck. Again, the common paranormal parlance, we don't have a vocabulary for some of the research I'm doing. So I have to create a new thesaurus, a new syllabus to at least facilitate what I'm doing. And that's where ectomancy comes in.
And, you bring up a very interesting point, and that's the point of that technology swap. Even whenever you're talking, UFO lore, things like that, the idea of us harvesting technology from craft, us receiving technology through, agreements with alien civilizations, what have you, that is rife in the UFO UAP community. But when you start looking at specifically ritualistic magic, Salamnic magic, things like that, Enochian magic, John Dee being the founder of that, that is quite literally the purposes of that magic is to contact a spirit or spirits or entity or elemental to transmit a knowledge or power unto you. A technology, literally, be it a means by which to weave lead into gold, what have you. Even a spell or a sigil is in and of itself a technology when you start thinking about it. Because, I mean, a tool in and of itself or instrument is just something that you use to make a job easier. You know, you could absolutely long form magic something all day. But hey, a sigil is a great shorthand there that involves a lot of the planetary magic and alignments and even the shorthand of, Latin phrases, Greek phrases, right. Things like that. That's what the letters around the side and stuff are. They're parts of prayers and incantations, just the first letter of them, things like that.
Oh, yeah.
So it's fascinating to even consider that of itself.
Yes.
A technology.
Oh, absolutely. I think it is. And I'm going to use the term 1,000%. Alien technology, not because I believe they're extraterrestrial. But let's pay attention real quickly here. A sigil refers to a symbolic representation of the practitioner's desired outcome. All right. So that would mean that our earthly practitioners are writing, carving sigils in order to influence another power, right? Okay. But what about the other powers carving these emblems and symbols and sigils into us?
Yes.
Who are they trying to influence? So again, this is why, again, it transcends demonology, and it's kind of a lonely field right now. That's what I'm saying, right? I have photographic evidence of that occurring. Subdermal scarification from underneath the skin to the surface. So that would mean that all of demonology is severely limited in that there is a secondary intelligence here, in that they themselves are carving sigils that belong to even other entities.
Interesting. Almost in a way, marking somebody or a place for an entity.
Summoning
that entity there.
Right. There's us. There's them. And then there's even something else out there, my friend. And this is 100% what I believe is occurring in necronetics. This is why Father Sinistrari. See, I first thought that these incubi entities were carving symbols into their victims. They were.
Yeah.
They were sigils. And so it was almost like these victims were almost sacrifices, or these were.
They were the instrument of manifestation. That's quite literally what the sigil is used for. You know, you carve the sigil into your instrument, typically into your athame, what have you, you know, into the actual instrument that you're using. So, or on the ground, they're used as your circle of protection in some things where you stand in the middle of the sigil to summon the entity, things like that.
Yes. Pictorial signatures that are given to and designed by other entities, a higher life form. And so it's one thing for demonology to say, okay, yeah, we have practitioners who are carving these symbols and using these symbols that belong to demons. Okay, that's cute, right? That's antiquated. What we're looking at now, my friend, is literally whatever we're calling demons doing that to us. So there's or what we would call demons. So there's the hierarchy present.
Yeah.
That blew my mind. And I mean, it's not just the incubi victims. We see that in ufology. We're even seeing that in abductions.
Mm. And it could very well be the source of a lot of things that you hear, and especially accounts of alien abduction, presence, shadow people, things like that, where when people invoke the name of Christ – mm-hmm. or begin to pray, that the experience stops. Mm-hmm. You know, once again, not necessarily that they have to play by our rules, but it also means that at that moment you are revoking some form of agency as well and gaining your own back.
Yes.
Which of course your exerted agency can change things.
Yes, absolutely. And with that, I think it's worth noting that whatever is occurring when we're in contact with the phenomenon, it almost manifests in the soulish dimension. Mm. What I mean by that is the subdermal scarification is not limited to demonology. With Betty Luca, she was out of her body. Then when she got back into her body, only then did her skin begin to manifest these anomalies. So is it possible, my friend, that a lot of these abductions with these scoop marks, it's happening to the soul first and the skin second? What's
interesting.
There's another moment.
Interesting.
There's another moment, buddy. Yeah. And then wow. when we go into hauntology, right? I had a case study like this where, you know, I was doing a lecture on scarifications and stuff. But anyways, I got an email. And this wasn't even the remote viewer. This was a lady who both her and her daughter were living alone. She's a single mother. They were living in a haunted house. And she said, you know, at first we felt the pain. Then underneath the skin, there were scratch marks and a burning sensation was felt. Then it moved itself to the surface of the skin. So this is crazy, but I believe that's what's happening. And I think that if that is happening, we need to start questioning whether or not the warfare is happening in the soulish dimension. Mm. And the influence is happening first to the soul and second to the skin, which would also have to go back, right? Scoop marks, devil marks, sigils, all of yeah. that. Now we have to go back to what Ezekiel chapter 13 would call false prophets and yeah. what was actually considered to be leprosy in biblical antiquity. And other people don't want me to talk about the Bible. Okay. If you don't like it,
I got no problems with it.
Cool to the side, right? I know you're good, buddy. But let's go down this rabbit hole for a fleeting moment. I know we don't have time.
Please, no, we got any time you need.
You got old Nate triggered. So there was a species of necromancers in the Bible, and they weren't just in the Bible. There were other words in the Akkadian text as well that were mentioning these specific practitioners. And they had rituals that they would perform on their victims in order to separate the soul from the body. Uh-oh.
Interesting.
This is very dark territory. Yeah, they were called soul hunters. And so what they would do then is they would trap the soul itself. And then in one text it says that they hunt men to make their souls fly. Those who hunt the souls of men, that they would fly, so that those who should die live. That's necromancy. Mm. And those who should live die. And so there was a process of killing in order to survive. Moving right along. In this is fascinating. In these references to these practitioners, they were also called false prophets. And these specific false prophets had the ability to kind of basically curse their victims with skin conditions, skin anomalies. Sure.
Yeah.
And in antiquity, they called this leprosy. Now, leprosy to them is not leprosy to us. Leprosy to us is Hansen's disease. Yeah. Leprosy to them was a spiritual condition first, and then a skin condition yeah. second.
Yeah. Leprosy was typically tied to what was considered to be the sins of the fathers, things like that.
Yes.
It was a generational curse that had come down upon you. That had been levied upon you in some way, much like, once again, that's the first thing that happened to Job. As soon as God yes. was like, okay, you can touch Job, but you can't kill him.
Right.
Boils all over his body.
Boils.
You know, things like that. So yeah, the fact that they are able to do these things, that they are able to, psychosomatically pull these illnesses out. You know, even if it's yes. the fact of the psychosomatic illness is in and of itself a tulpish representation of what is going on inside of the person's head and a manifestation, tulpa-wise. Mm-hmm. And that Absolutely. Illness is a tulpish manifestation in that kind of way.
Absolutely. Yeah. It's their concept of this leprosy was soul first, skin second.
Yeah.
And in fact, what they would do is they would present themselves to the priests, and the priests would ask them, have you been in contact with what? These false prophets. Because they realized through pattern confirming evidence that those who were in contact with these false prophets would often come back with skin anomalies. This is fascinating stuff. But yeah, that's another wow. reference. It could be, I should say, another reference, right, to whatever these practitioners are doing.
Yeah.
To and, where whatever's happening to the soul.
Yep.
It's now manifesting through the skin.
And that was quite literally the root of a lot of Abrahamic funerary rite.
Yeah.
Was the idea of soul and soul exchange, and even the idea of like get them blessed, get them wrapped, get them buried as soon as possible so that something doesn't come reincarnate them or that yeah. something or that they don't come and reincarnate.
There we go.
Because that was yes. that was a huge part, especially reincarnation within generation. Within generational lines. So like a grandparent reincarnating in a son. You know,
oh,
things like that.
Yes.
Which also carries along that generational curse concept once again that, hey, just because you died doesn't absolve you of the sins that you had when you were there. Correct. Sorry that you reincarnated in your grandson, but this is what you're stricken with now because of that.
Yes. Now this is necronetics, right?
Yeah.
We're circling right back, my friend. Yeah, necronetics would be the not just the reincarnation, but the transmigration of the soul. And we see that mostly in Jewish mysticism. Necronetics teaches that a lot of times, specifically with the practitioners, the implanting of the fetus into the woman, they are the father of that son. But when they place their consciousness into that son, when you've seen the son, you've seen the father. And so there is this transmigration of the soul and to which, again, possession would be pregnancy. And it is. That's why I think that possession as a phenomenon has been largely misunderstood and monopolized by religious systems. Then I believe on behalf of the proto-intelligence, there are entities that do not want us to know. Gilgal. This is also, by the way, called the doctrine of Gilgal, which is the wheel of souls.
Yep.
Which goes back again to the circle of transmigration and reincarnation.
Yeah. Yeah. And once again, the idea of these things generationally, even moving within bloodlines, mm-hmm. because of the consent, things like that. It's absolutely interesting, Nathaniel, the way that, this, And I love the term ectomancy. I really like that. The idea that these spirits themselves are wielding a magic.
Yes. And it's alien to us.
Yeah. Yeah. And in that truest sense of the term alien, you know, from somewhere else, not necessarily mm-hmm. extraterrestrial in origin or anything like that, but possibly from right here. Now, does that predicate the fact that at one point they were us, Nathaniel, or are they a different entity entirely?
Well, this again, now we're trapped within language.
Sure.
What would we call a ghost that has been denatured? Mm. Right. It would essentially be a battery that's trying to remember itself. And so then it would have to trap memory within matter in order to preserve its existence. And so what does it do? This gets back to implants, right? In necromancy and in Mesopotamia, where they carve the name of the entity in an implant, piece of metal, implant that into a body. And so memory merged with matter, and then they merge that matter with the biological avatar. But my theory right now is at least that some of these beings are formerly human, and that in order to facilitate and rehabilitate what I call their disability of being, they have to continually make new avatars. Ancient surgeons, characterization of mess. There we go, brother.
Daddy's quick on the fingers, man.
Yes. Now, by the way, in Ezekiel 13, because this ties right into that.
Please.
There's a Hebrew word that the author employs. It's translated in the KJV as pillows. The same Hebrew word for pillows is used for the word skin. And so essentially what the author was describing was a species of necromancer that was almost using an ancient form of skin grafting to create a new biological avatar to inhabit.
Yeah.
Crazy stuff. So that would be what we would call technology.
Yeah. Yeah. And even the idea of, you know, they have seen vanity and lying divination saying the Lord saith and the Lord hath not sent him. But the idea of that lying divination, is fascinating. You know, the idea of them giving you false divine words and words to a false doctrine, quite literally.
Yes.
Now with that being said, granted, without getting crazy religious, Nathaniel, because once again, this is a concept that spans religions, and also a book here and a text that spans religions, from ancient Hebrew to modern Christianity. So this text about false prophets, this idea of being implanted with something and even having a technology or a trope implanted in you falsely translates directly into modern society, you know, and the ways in which false information gets down the pipeline and muddies the clear waters of actual information in the world around us. You know, this is an everyday struggle, whether you're talking spirituality or just trying to spit shine what news you're reading, man. Mm-hmm. You know?
Yeah, the propaganda is real. And I know that what's happened in the field of the paranormal is that the phenomenon has weaponized these archetypes and tropes. And a lot of them, again, this is a way to snuff out the veil and the mask. It's like, okay, is that even historically accurate?
Yeah.
Is that, you know, did that even exist? You know, if you guys watch this last season of Unsolved Mysteries, you'll see some of my heroes in the field, Dr. Barry Fitzgerald and Steve Mara, in episode, I think, 5.
Yep.
And they're dealing with a psychic who is in contact with a guide named Becky. And this is going to prove my point. And so the phenomenon is weaponizing the archetype of the guide. Her name's Becky. And so Becky's given all kinds of information. It's amazing, right? It's prophecies are being all kinds of stuff.
Yep.
Well, they ask Becky her life story. She gives them her life story. Well, they go to her hometown. Here we go. To vet the life story. She never existed at all. Right? And so this is what we're seeing in the field where it's like, okay, even if it's demonic, what do you mean? Horns and hoofs? Sure. Okay. Find out the Bible. Because, so you start to see that these are literally just embodiments to where the phenomenon just wants to blend into our reality.
Yeah. Yeah.
Whatever I'm willing to believe in, it will become. But that doesn't mean, right, that's what it is. It's just wearing that mask.
Precisely.
It's really interesting.
Yeah, yeah. And you know, once again, that is where a lot of my research has led me, is that there is something there that is willing to wear that mask for the moment so that you're comfortable and it can pass and go about its business. You know,
absolutely.
Because otherwise, why haven't these sightings in this kind of way happened before then? You know, why haven't Bigfoot been popping out of portals since 1957?
There we go.
You know,
and why is it that a lot of these entities, again, they're projections of orbs?
Yeah.
I mean, you know,
in the presence and the presence of orbs. Because that's another one with Bigfoot. That's another one with quite a few cryptids where that is something preceding. Common in UFO, common in paranormal, you know?
Yes, dude, precisely. In this, you know, you look at this and the idea that you know, it will manifest according to my intent.
Yeah.
Well, let's look at the Skoll experiment. They never intended to contact aliens, to my knowledge, but perhaps they did. But I remember one night, again, they're trying to contact deceased loved ones. And I think at the very end they did. But my point is, you know, they set up the tripod and then shut the doors. They could wake up the next day, look at it, and there's an ET staring at them through the lens.
Yeah.
And somebody said, well, that could be, you know, aliens are implementing and hijacking the same stream of consciousness. No. It's not consciousness we're after. That would be like me calling T-Mobile and Verizon picks up. I'm not dealing, right, with the connection. I'm dealing with the intention determining
that's right
the destination.
Yeah.
It's so right. It's so essentially what I'm pointing at here is that, yeah, what we're looking at is UFOs being present in seances. And even now, my friend, and I said this before, probably my last show, now we have parapsychological conferences in Europe where they're literally performing necromancy to contact aliens.
Yeah. Yeah. And you strange. Know, and that's just it. Like there are mass CE5 events that happen at events, things like that. And I don't know, man, I'm for it and against it, you know, like, hey, I'll be honest with you, man. A piece of merch that I considered and actively started designing. And then I was like, I don't need to put any more into this. I was going to make Curious Realm answer boards. And I was like, I don't know if I should be encouraging everybody and their mother to be playing with an answer board.
Yeah.
Like, responsibly. Well, should I do that? You know? And no, I don't believe I should. I don't believe I should be encouraging everybody to go out there with an answer board and a pendulum, because you are putting an energy out there. You are putting an intent out there with that. And unless, once again, you are somebody who is spiritually adept and grounded within yourself and all means to know the difference between foreign influence and your own influence spiritually, you shouldn't be playing with that either, you know, because something else may manifest itself. You know, and by all right, honestly, by all right, you have given it the intent, you know.
You've given it, in a sense, you've given it obedience. I go back to Jerry Barzinski's work when he had been dealing with an addict. And this individual is a business executive, right? He's very well dressed when he comes into the clinic to get clean. And he would get clean and then he would leave and then get back on drugs and everything. Well, anyways, he asked him one day, like, what's going on? This is fascinating right here. He said, well, he goes, let me tell you what my life's like. I go to bed at midnight sober. You know, I'm clean for 3 months. I go to bed 2:30 in the morning. A voice comes to me, get in the car. Why? I get in the car. I drive for 30 minutes, turn right, turn left. I have no idea where I'm going. And then stop the car, go into that White House. Knocks on the door. It's a dealer.
Yeah.
So, sure. And this is what the Collins Elite realized in their research with respect to ritual magic, was that there appears to be entities that are conjuring us to conjure them and allowing us to believe in the illusion of control.
Yeah.
And then when we're there, right, it's just like George Hunt Williamson when he created a homemade Ouija board. By the time he's done, he has multiple voices coming out of him.
Yeah.
Well, they weren't after the Ouija board.
Uh-uh.
They were after George Hunt Williamson.
Well, and, you know, that goes right back to the work of Malachi Martin as well, which I can definitely say as somebody who's dealt with addiction in my life, I have experienced. And that is the point of demonic obsession. Mm-hmm. Demoniac obsession, which comes before the point of possession, where you, especially he saw it in addicts he always said that as he walked the streets, he saw the eyes of the possessed around him all the time, because of this concept of demoniac obsession, whether it's alcoholism, whether it's drug abuse, hard drug use, things like that. You have submitted your will to something else. and you have submitted your will, kind of like that old commercial of, you know, the guy walking around his desk in a cocaine bottle. I work harder so I can make more money, so I can work harder, so I can buy more drugs, so I can work harder, so I can make more money. You know, it eventually becomes the fact of, if you are an addict, you have submitted part of your will to that substance.
Yeah.
And you have now surrendered that part of your will to something that now has control over you. And you will do things that are uncharacteristic of you. You will lie. You will steal. You'll do all kinds of things in want and in search of that substance. And that's a point of demoniac obsession. You have given an obsession of yourself over to this thing.
Oh, yeah.
And it's one step away from demonic possession, where you fully give yourself and your will over. You know, and I will say that I've definitely walked that line in my life, and it's not a happy place. It's not a good place. And it's dangerous. Scary. It's dangerous. And a lot of people live there, Nathaniel. A lot of people. You know them. I know them.
They do. A good friend of mine, if I may.
Please.
A good friend of mine was an alcoholic, and he told me a story. This blew my mind. This is even before I discovered Jerry Marzinski's work. But he said that he went to a gas station. He was sober for a few months, went to a gas station to get an energy drink, and he locked his doors, goes in the gas station, comes back out. There is a tall boy in a brown bag in the seat of the passenger seat.
Oh, my God.
Doors are locked. This is going to blow your mind. This is almost like, oh, my God. Yeah. And he asked him. He brought the beer back into the gas station and asked him, "Have you had any customers in the last hour or two besides me? Been pretty dead around here." Okay. And he pulled the beer out of the paper bag. "Do you even sell this here?" "Never seen it. We don't sell it."
Wow. Wow.
Send shivers down my spine.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's just it. You know, it's one of those, once you've consented into that system, hurdles will continue to be thrown in your way. And on both sides, Nathaniel, whether you choose the path of light or the path of dark, it's kind of horrifying. It's kind of horrifying because, once again, to loop this right back to the beginning of the conversation, even joining the seminary, that's one of the first things they tell you is, like, prepare for the target on your back.
Yeah.
You know?
Absolutely.
And if you choose that other side of things, addiction-wise, things like that, prepare for the target on your back. You know, so it's fascinating to see either side of the spectrum you choose to migrate toward. That danger is readily there and readily available, you know.
Oh, yeah.
And once again, it plays by a different set of rules. That idea of necronetics, I like the terminology that you are beginning to use with this, Nathaniel, because it really does. It really migrates it into its own field of study and into its own concept. Because, things like incubus and succubus have been thrown around way too long. It's much like I say regularly, there are way too many Kleenex bins in the world of paranormal study that preclude other researchers from wanting to get involved. You know, like, I am a big fan of the relabeling to UAP from UFO because, regular and hard science doesn't want to study UFOs. That's hearsay and conjecture. However, if you're talking phenomena, oddly enough, there are books, literal scientific reference books about strange phenomena. This is a scientific desk reference of articles that go back to the late 1700s about ball lightning, swamp gas, things like that, about actual phenomena. Science.
That's awesome.
Science. Yes. Phenomena. Right there. You know, scientific desk reference, folks, from the 1970s. More. So it wasn't too dang long ago that the like the early 1900s and we lost track of it. This is 1974, the year before I was born. All right. So, you know, that is the backyard of science. That's literally their job, is to find out what happened to the 5% of solution because we don't have 100% anymore. Did it off gas? Did it go to sediment? What was the phenomena that led to the solution losing 5% overnight? That's the job of science, you know? So when you change these terminologies, it changes the lens through which things are seen, Nathaniel. And the fact that you are hard defining these things, or not hard defining, but redefining these things using terms like tulpomancy, ectomancy, necronetics, it's fantastic because it really does separate it and pull the veil aside to put them into their own category and create their own distinct phenomenology for study.
Phenomenal. I love it. Thank you for the compliment, brother. And, you know, especially coming from you, it makes me happy and makes me feel good too.
Well, no, and rightfully so, because you have done tons of good hard work and research into this topic. I hear these things brought up in numerous communities, man. And I've heard other interviews with you, and it's fantastic to see that your work really does stand apart in this way, especially when it comes to like we talk about on this show all the time, the fact that there seems to be a slice of these other phenomena that fall in this backyard of what you're talking about, Nathaniel, where there is something else. There is something else, brother, that is using us as a means and as a gateway. And it's awesome. Before we let you go, let everybody know where they can go to follow, like, subscribe, where they can go to keep up with your work, where they can go to find your work, Nathaniel.
So these days I am on Instagram. I'm not on Facebook. I'm not even on Facebook Messenger at this point.
Nope.
But yeah. So if you guys want to follow my research, I post the most often on Instagram. You guys can get hold of me there. Just private message me and I'll be more than happy to respond. For those who want to follow my research by virtue of interviews, you can go to my YouTube channel. I have, of course, it's under my name, Nathaniel Gillis. I have a playlist of all of my guest appearances, and it's been a long ride, but I think I'm up to 140 something just on YouTube alone.
Wow.
So you guys can kind of go through all those interviews to catch up to where I'm at in my research.
Wow. That is awesome. And of course we have that embedded right there on our website, on our videos page. We have awesome. All the videos from all of our guests, all their video channels, things like that. So it's nice, easy for people to find. You can go right there, folks, to follow and subscribe to everything that Nathaniel does and all the interviews that he does. Because once again, this research stands apart from anybody else in the field. I don't think anybody else is looking at or considering the true concepts of dark Enochian and Solemnic magic being used by entities. So beautiful stuff, Nathaniel.
Thank you, brother.
Hold the line real quick while we close things out and throw to Dr. John Hall. While you are online checking out everything from Nathaniel Gillis, following him on Instagram as well as going to curiousrealm.com/videos to subscribe to his page his channel on YouTube. Make sure to go by curiousrealm.com. curiousrealm.com/store is where you can find Nathaniel's book, A Moment Called Man, as well as all of the books and classes, things like that, videos from our guests. Everything that is purchased there goes to support Curious Realm, of course. And don't forget about Curious Research, which now has the official field observation and encounter log. If you are a field investigator in the world of paranormal, if you're an investigator in the world of cryptids, UFOs, UAPs out in the field, this is your log to put down all the data from your investigations as it happens. So your data is ready in a scientific way to shake hands with science come the day that happens. So, which is rapidly approaching in all of these fields, as we talk about regularly. Stay tuned through these quick commercial breaks. We will be right back and talk with Dr. John Hall about the world of targeted individuals, targeting technologies, and the ever-changing front in the world of Havana Syndrome. We will talk about that and so much more with John Hall when we come back from this break right after this, folks.
The key to good science is good research. At the heart of good research is a good data set. With the field observation and encounter log from Curious Research, you can easily keep track of your investigative information all in one place, making it easier to review cases and readily see comparisons and contrasts between them. Whether out in the woods squatching, in a back room gathering EVPs, or using high-tech gear to track UFO UAP activity, this easy-to-carry, pocket-sized scientific data log is the perfect companion for any field researcher. You can find your copy of the Curious Research Field Observation and Encounter Log at Amazon.com or visit the official Curious Realm store at CuriousRealm.com/store to reserve your copy for yourself, your family, or a mind that you want to open. That website again is CuriousRealm.com/store.
Well, hello, everybody, and welcome back from that quick break. Thank you so much to our awesome guest and friend, Nathaniel Gillis. The last part of that episode really just blew my mind, talking about the demonic body snatchers. It's always a topic that I love talking about with him. Amazing research. Thank you once again to our sponsors, Truhem Science. If you are looking for CBD products for yourself, like I use Truhem Science. I was recommended CBD for my travel anxiety by my doctor, probably about 6 years ago. And that is when I went on a search nationwide as I traveled the country for work and found Truhem Science right here in my backyard in Austin, Texas. Christopher Lynch produces an amazing product, made through a spigeric process. Every part of the plant is used, combusted, and reused until nothing is left. And it provides a full spectrum end product that has terpene profiles unlike any other. Amazing, amazing stuff. Stop on by, check them out. TrueHemScience.com is the website that you want to go to. Curious7 is the code that you want to use to save 7% off your entire cart of $50 or more and get two, count them, two edibles on your way out the door. Our guest in this segment, he is the author of Guinea Pigs, Technologies of Control, the book that we have up on screen right now, as well as A New Breed, Satellite Terrorism in America. Welcome back to the show, our good friend and guest, Dr. John Hall. How are you doing, my friend?
Great, Chris. Great to be back on, too. How are you?
Doing all right, man. Not too bad. It is a new year. You know, this is the new year episode. We're coming in on a new year. And I am hoping that not only with the UFO, UAP stuff, but with targeted individuals and with human rights here in America, that we start taking further steps in the right direction, Doctor.
Well, I think, I mean, it's, you know, I hate always to get political on your show, but I think we made the right choice as far as the election. You know, it's kind of weird, you know, all the years that I've been kind of at the forefront of the activism for targeted individuals and against that, you know, kind of invasion on our privacy. Most of the people I work with tend to be Democrats at heart. And unfortunately, at least the Democratic Party and a lot of Republicans, but the party itself and the Democratic Party seems to kind of be the political arm of the intelligence community. And one reason I'm saying that it's probably a good choice that we got who we've got going to the presidency is looking to see who he's already appointing to positions on the cabinet. I think we're finally going to maybe see somebody try to get the intelligence community, you know, back under some oversight. And that's what I've said for years, you know, when everybody else was looking for, you know, ways to block it, you know, or ways to scramble the signal or a chip that you can remove to make it go away. I've always said that the solutions are going to be almost solely political.
Yeah. Yeah. And you know, I hate saying that as well. However, Much like, you know, do I like relabeling UFO to UAP? No. However, it now pulls the topic out of the catch-all bin and puts it into the world of, you know, phenomena, which is actual science. Like, science can't argue with phenomena. As a matter of fact, they have to figure out what the phenomenon is so that they can exclude the phenomenon from their experiment. You know? So, and by doing that, it caused a whole nother conversation amongst the halls of Congress. And with that, the way I keep putting it, Doctor, is that will we end up with an aha moment where they wheel out a huge tube and pull off a drapery and inside's an alien body? No. No, that's not what is going to happen in Congress, nor will they wheel out a big old piece of wreckage or anything like that. What will happen is that you'll end up with somebody going down like Ollie North, either from an alphabet agency or the contractors thereof, who are responsible for the retrieval of these things and who have been, you know, hoarding billions of dollars since 1945, you know? And that's just it. We've got to find where the purse strings lead so that we can choke the people with the purse strings into submission with the purse strings.
Well, and you know, with non-consensual experimentation, I even mentioned it in one of my books that if you look at past history, it's about 40 to 50 years after the egregious event happens that the government usually has a State Department person or somebody come forward and go, well, yeah, you know, we did experiment on these, you know, people with syphilis and gonorrhea and weaponized, you know, bacteria and viruses or radiation. And now we're going to apologize for it and say that it was in the best interest of national security. But usually that's after they know the true victims have already passed on and the apology has been given to family members. And when I wrote my first book, I was hoping that I would garner enough attention to this problem that wouldn't be the case with targeting. That, you know, that we would eventually get the right people in government with the right morality, you know, to actually bring it to the forefront, maybe have, you know, another Rockefeller commission or church committee hearing, that type of thing. I would rather have that than, you know, another Acre hearing, you know, 15, 20 years down the road. You know, for those of your listeners that don't know what the Acre hearings were, that was when Clinton allowed all the evidence to be brought forward of how people were experimented on with radiation, you know, during the 40s and the 50s, especially in Arizona and New Mexico and Nevada.
Yeah.
And a lot of people died of cancer due to that. And, you know, well, at least 60 years later, they got their apology.
Well, and another prime example is Japanese Americans. We literally interned every single one of them into an internment camp during World War II. They got their reparations in 88.
Yeah.
You know, same thing with Tuskegee and all that kind of stuff. You know, I don't think they ever actively got any kind of like reparation or anything like that. The Tuskegee Airmen who were exposed to the Tuskegee experiments, nor did the guys, I'm trying to remember what it was, the Jacob's Ladder guys that were exposed to the chemical that the movie Jacob's Ladder was based on.
Yeah.
That was all based on a real story. And there was an entire platoon of army guys that were being fed like gaseous LSD derivatives and things like that drove them crazy. There's a whole documentary on it, really wild stuff, but, and hopefully, you know, once again, not to get political, anything like that. I think all presidents at some point do something good, much like, hey, Joe Biden, the, 2021, we got the Havana Act. You know, the helping American victims afflicted by neurological attacks, Havana Act of 2021 was signed by Biden in October of 2021, provides for the possibility of one-time lump sum payments for those affected by anomalous health incidents. So yeah, you know, the affected by neurological attacks, the Havana syndrome folks, things like that also would apply to targeted individuals.
Yep.
At some point. So the plus side is because we already have this act. If we can get a couple other things on paper, because once again, it's going to be a legal solution that makes these people bend to will, you know, and like we've discussed time and time again, doctor, is it necessarily the Alphabet agency doing it? Likely not. However, have they granted technology and use of it to ill actors that are contracted by them, things like that, much like the government no longer actively does remote viewing or funds it. However, they perfectly employ quite a number of independent contractors.
Oh, yeah. The NGOs.
Who do employ remote viewing. And this is known to them that their contractors are, so, you know, very much the same thing. Is the Alphabet agency doing it? Likely not. However, it's actors and malactors of them and contractors thereof who have access to it, who are either testing it or using it.
Well, and that's the group that I discovered that was doing this in the Central Texas area was a former FBI agent, and his son was a retired lieutenant colonel with the DOD. So, I mean, that was their access to the technology. They were just kind of being allowed to use it however they wanted to use it. And, you know, when we did the early studies on victims of this technology, that's exactly what we found, is that it was almost always contractors that were doing the victimizing, you know, with some type of clearance to be able to access the weaponry.
Yeah.
Doing the targeting. But when you looked at the mix, like the group here, kind of basically they're hired guns. You know, if you need to make your wife look crazy in a divorce in order to not pay child support, then you hire this guy and he does the gang stalking and has your soon to be ex hearing voices and making herself look crazy. And that's exactly what happened with a particular orthopedic surgeon here in the San Antonio area, actually in the, you know, Fredericksburg area. And it turns out it was the PI group that was victimizing his wife was the same PI group that I identified victimizing the girl that I wrote about in my first book.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it's, you know, at least in this group, they're doing it for profit.
Now there was
a group in San Francisco that was targeting gay men. There was a group in New York that was targeting black, you know, people, African American people. So, you know, each group has access to the technology. Now, how they choose to use it is, you know, varies from group to group. And in the long run, the mix is kind of a general sample of the public. You know, because at the top, they're just interested in getting the data.
Well, and you know, that was something interesting that we got into last time that we had you on, where we started talking about very specific types of people and personalities and things like that that seem to be more prone to these things, people that have had specific injury, people that have had very specific things, can be more prone to this. And I will even give a confession here on air, doctor, because I should have actively called you privately. But at least three times in the last month, I'm up pretty late doing my astrophotography, things like that. After my wife goes to bed, my kid's long in bed. And no less than three times in the last month, as I sit in my living room, which is right next to my back patio where I do my astrophotography, directly above us is the attic, things like that. And it's not a hugely walkable attic. You know, it's not like it's planked out or anything. But three times in the last month, I have distinctly heard what sounds like somebody moving around and walking in my attic, like the weight of a person on a joist. Moving around and joist and like hearing it across a few of them. Just all of a week ago, my wife was putting my boy to bed and things like that. I had put my stuff outside and closed the door. And I was sitting there and heard something fall outside, like something boom, 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 boom. Like something got caught in a leg. And it was a big green, like, water jug for plants that had been moved off my patio and off into the grass. That one actively had me go get my pistol. I'm not even joking. I will also say on air, I am not having any suicidal thoughts. I've definitely heard a lot of high-pitched rings, things like that. But I've felt a lot of wild things. I'm not saying that I'm in no way suicidal, anything like that. All right.
Well, Chris, you've got to remember too.
I'm funked out than I typically am. I can tell you that, like, emotionally.
Well, your show has been one of the more prevalent shows that advocates for targeted individuals, and with some, including me and some of the other guests you have on. Yeah. Talking about it, it wouldn't surprise me. I mean, you're probably on the list, as we say.
I'm on some government lists, I can tell you.
Yeah, well, and there's really only two shows left that they talk about targeting to, you know, with any reality based things with it. And I don't know if I'm allowed to plug someone else, but
sure.
it would be you and Clyde Lewis. The other show that tends to dabble in paranormal stuff or conspiratorial stuff won't touch this with a 10-foot pole anymore. No. Yeah, they were told not to.
Yeah. And you know, it's a hard topic. It's not an easy one. It's one that, as we say all the time, every time I do an episode with you, it normally rings up at least a good three responses, and a couple of those are normally, how can I get a hold of Dr. John Hall? You know?
Well, I don't know if Clyde or Ron Patton has ever told you this, but it was right after the Havana Syndrome thing broke, and I was doing Ground Zero.
Yep.
And they got a call, and it came up on the caller ID, Central Intelligence Agency. And basically they were shut down off of air. I mean, because at the time they were on WAI here in San Antonio.
Yep.
And you know, I could listen to the show, you know, as I'm being on it, you know, or have family members listen to the show as I'm being on it.
Yeah.
And I mean, when they shut down the, you know, I mean, their ability to get to be on the air, the transmission, it was off the rest of the night. I mean, they weren't able to get back on till the next day.
Wow.
And they were told on that call, I think, that they were, if they continued down this line of conversation, that they were going to be shut down. So, you know, and probably for good reason, because I think the powers that be, they knew when they came out with that Havana Syndrome thing, and they were trying to say, well, you know, it's like an acoustic weapon. No, and it's not an acoustic weapon. Acoustic weapons won't do that. You know, then they went to, well, it's pesticide. Then they went to, it's crickets chirping. Well, you know, permethrin, we've been dousing ourselves in it for, you know, about 100 years now, and it's not making everybody hear voices. And for those that don't, the Havana Syndrome thing, for those who have believed the press stories that these people were just hearing loud pitched noises and humming, they were having every single symptom that targeted individuals have. Havana Syndrome is targeting. So.
Yeah. And you know, when you start looking at these things, an acute injury to the brain, such as but not limited to a concussion or penetrating injury, or as the consequence of an event that leads to permanent alterations in brain function, is demonstrated by confirming correlative findings on image studies. Which, of course, was really the deal breaker was when that was UPenn, right? That the MRIs and stuff came out of to show the soft tissue damage to the brain, very specifically, soft tissue damage, where it was like, this is a signature type of damage.
Well, and they were using a type of MRI called diffusion tensor imaging.
That's it.
And it shows you know, molecular tract damage. And we're actually using that a lot now in personal injury cases, people that have been, you know, rear-ended by cars or hit by 18-wheelers that have, you know, traumatic brain injury. But that's one of the things we're looking at possibly doing with the targeted individual population is doing a study where we basically mimic the same exams and everything that the Defense Health Agency did, including the diffusion tensor imaging. Because, I mean, we really kind of need to tag along with the research that's being done on the Havana syndrome victims. The problem, though, is that, you know, the intelligence community keeps still trying to write off even their own employees.
Yeah.
You know, the Canadian victims are suing the Canadian government, you know, for basically, you know, not taking it seriously. And you're right, Biden did pass the Havana Syndrome Act, which, you know, allowed basically an individual from the Defense Health Agency to send me their workup and their recommendations to military facilities of how to work up a Havana Syndrome case.
Yeah.
And it's a pretty thick packet, and it goes through all the, you know, do this, do this, do this, do this, do this. And the one interesting thing I can tell you is I went through that entire packet. The one thing they don't do with any of the Havana Syndrome victims is look for an implant.
Hmm.
You know, and they clearly mention that, you know, in the instructions on how to work up a Havana Syndrome patient, they clearly mention that, you know, if they've been around any microwave energy weapons, or, you know, that if they mention microwave energy effect, that, you know, to take it seriously and to examine these people. But not once in that packet do they have any type of scanning or radio frequency scanning or anything that is there to pick up an implant, which tells me they know damn well it's not being done that way.
Yeah. Yeah. That would be pretty indicative at that point. To not include that. Now let's get into that real quick. As far as technology, things like that go, Doctor, because of course people hear implant and the first thing they think is like, oh, well, I would have had to have undergone some kind of medical procedure. You know, that's something that's going to be pretty large, right? That's what most people would think. What are the facts behind modern implants and the technology, because you're actively getting ready to release a new book, which has already gone through its DOD checks, right?
Yeah.
If I'm not mistaken. And that's something that a lot of people don't realize is that the books that you've written, like, these are not fiction. They're actual books. They're talking about actual technology, and to the point of fact that, like, you actively have to have your stuff cleared by the Department of Defense because you're talking about, well, active technologies and methods and things like that that are viable.
Yeah, and that, you know, and, you know, the late Robert Duncan went through the same things, and you know, including, you know, we both had visits, you know, asking for, you know, our information and,
yeah,
you know, our articles and, you know, what we have. And, and they don't schedule an appointment with you. They just show up. So, I mean, it, you know, and the same thing happened to Robert as well, you know, because I remember he called me one day and he goes, you're not going to believe this. There was an alphabet agency showed up at my house at like 10 o'clock at night, and, you know, and then tried to claim it was a mistake. You know, but it, you know, it was a shot across the bow, you know, but yeah, I mean, there's a believe it or not, everybody says, well, America doesn't have censorship. We do. And they reserve the right to censor. And if they put a block on your writing, then nobody can distribute it.
Yeah.
And, you know, we did a TV series about targeting, the Discovery Channel actually recorded. Yep. And they called me and they said, you know, this was long before Jesse Ventura's conspiracy theory. Yeah. And they called me and they said, we really want to do a special on this. And would they pick, you know, three or four different targeted individuals? And they used me as an expert. They had Richard Sirrett, who's kind of the George Norrie of Canada. He does a conspiracy theory show up there. Good guy. And Rob Demarest, who was a ghost hunter and a technology guy. And we shot, you know, 1.5 episodes for the Discovery Channel, and then they were told not to air it in America. So they changed the name to the United States of Paranoia and showed it on Discovery Europe. So, I mean, if you Google United States of Paranoia, you might be able to find an episode or two.
Yeah, you'll probably have to use a VPN, folks.
Yes.
In order to do that, in order to access most things through the UK, stuff like that, you have to actively have a UK IP address. So, not to give you methods and methodology, everybody. I'm not telling you how to make money or anything like that. Okay. But that's how you do it. I have quite a few guests on the show and even friends who have things that release in the UK. And yeah, like I pay for a VPN service every year just so that I can do things like that. And watch content that's only available in Saudi Arabia, you know, things like that.
Well, and, you know, after we filmed that series for Discovery Channel, you know, I had tried to get a hold of them several times. And I said, well, is this thing ever going to come out? And, you know, whatever happened to it? And you never could get a straight answer from until finally I got, they said, well, we were told not to air it. Well, it was then, now they didn't tell me that they put it on in Europe. I actually got sent a copy of the video of one of the episodes from a fan, or one of somebody who's read one of my books or both of my books, from Finland, that emailed me I guess she sat and recorded it, watching, you know, and recorded it off of her TV, and then sent me it on a YouTube link. So that's how I knew that it had been actually finally published in Europe.
Wow. Wow.
But United States of Paranoia, if anybody's interested, you know, then that's, you know, and if you're in the targeted individual community, you'll recognize at least one of the people that was on that show. So,
the fact is, yes, we do have a type of censorship. Are we freer than most other countries, even the UK, as far as what we can say? Hell yes. All day long, even as far as what we can access on the internet. Most people don't realize that. Like, feel free to visit a foreign country and try to visit every single site that you go to. You won't be able to access some of them, you know, because they just aren't available there. I myself have had episodes that are banned in the Middle East, things like that, because of the content that we talk about in that episode, you know, talking about end times prophecies, things like that. The episodes have been banned in the Middle East. So, it's fascinating to see that. It's interesting to see how even the dialogue of something like this can be changed in that way, Doctor. Even the dialogue of being able to openly talk about targeted individuals, targeting technologies, things like that, changes. The horizons of that change when you don't have that open layer of free speech.
But that one thing that did really interest me that we were talking about earlier is when I finally got my hands on that Defense Health Agency guide to, you know, and this is their basically, it's telling their other medical officers, these are the steps you will follow through when somebody comes in and complains of an anomalous health incident. That's what, and you're right, that's what they're called now, AHIs. And they don't necessarily call it Havana syndrome. And especially since now it's happened to a bunch of people in D.C., it's happened to people in China and, you know, other places that were victims in D.C.
Yep.
So, but The one thing is, I went through this thing with a fine tooth comb, and one of the things I'm always asked by victims is, shouldn't I go get a radio frequency scan, you know, to see if there's something emitting in me, if there's some type of a implant in me. They did no RF scanning on any other victims, none. So, and one of the doctors that worked at UPenn actually made a comment that, kind of anonymously said, you know, we already knew what it was. So, I mean, there's even kind of some chicanery going on, you know, even in the, with the government workers that are being looked at. I mean, there's a handful of doctors that, you know, kind of want to give the right diagnosis and point everybody in the right direction. And there's a handful of intelligence people who are going to continue to blame it on anxiety. You know, the document that got sent to Congress blamed it squarely on anxiety.
Yeah. Yeah. And the once again, the medical diagnoses took a long time to pin down and to actually show that it was a congruent symptomology between patients. And the fact that the Canadian government had it happen, numerous governments have had it happen. To start going into implants, things like that. We've got about 30 minutes left in the conversation. Let's start moving in to some of this technology and what the modus operandi of it is, Doctor.
Well, I mean, I can tell you 20 years ago when all this started, the first implant, now we scanned a lot of people and we found very few implants. I will tell you that, you know, right up front, you know, we probably scanned over 1,000 people. And there were a handful of people that we did find that had implants in them. One of them was Bob Boyce. You know, he was an inventor in Georgia, and he had allegedly invented a way to charge batteries using free energy. People from the NSA came to talk to him, were interested in his patent, took him out drinking, and he, several days later, you know, noticed that there was a frequency in his anechoic chamber that he did his research in that shouldn't have been there. And when he traced it back, it traced back to his shoulder. And the particular chip that they put in him caused cancerous changes. He wound up with melanoma around that implant, and it was a Verichip that they had put in him, and that Verichip came back registered to the NSA. So, you know, at that point, they were still using chips that, you know, if you were going to look for them, you could find. You know, a Verichip, you know, lights up like a Christmas tree on an X-ray. So that kind of hearkened us to do, you know, a pretty ambitious scanning program that was kind of headed up by me and Jesse Beltran. He even took a group overseas that used a industrial grade, research grade anechoic chamber, you know, that stops any frequency from coming in to see if people would, their symptoms would improve if you put them in those chambers, and they did. But that being said, even though we would do all this scanning, sometimes you would find emissions coming from the body, sometimes not. But even on the ones that you did, oftentimes you couldn't back that up with an X-ray of a clearly visible implant. We did on a handful of individuals, but, you know, the great majority of people that are targeted, you know, we didn't find anything on scanning, you know, or X-ray, which kind of brings us to modern era with nanotechnology. Now, with nanotechnology, you're not necessarily going to find anything on an X-ray. You might have a positive RF scan, but, you know, that nanotechnology is so small that about the only hope is that you might find tissue changes around that technology. And that takes, you know, 3.0 Tesla coils in an MRI, you know, as well as maybe sometimes ultrasound. But even then, you have to narrow it down to an area of the body to look at. You can't, just do a 3.0 Tesla MRI from head to toe on somebody, not feasibly. And that's kind of what gets back to my original statement, is that in the eventual end, it's going to be a political solution. Yeah. Because, you know, I know a lot of the target individuals are constantly looking for a way to block it, or a way to find an implant, or a way to stop an implant if you do find it. And man, it's the money that you have to spend to get to those ends,
yeah,
is a lot more than just electing the right people that are going to have a hearing, you know, and have the government say, yeah, it's us, you know. Because I mean, it's personally, it's my theory that I don't think it's the Russians that were targeting the diplomats in Havana Syndrome or China or anywhere else or in DC. I think it's us.
Interesting. And you know, once again, to further explore the idea, to what ends is this technology being used? You know, and granted, you know, hell, man, we build magnificent, beautiful things with hammers. Take one to a skull and it's a different thing. You know, any technology can be used and twisted in a horrible way. You know, movies are great, beautiful, moving pieces of art that move humanity in different ways, but replace a few frames every second, you know, and you'd be surprised what you can make the mind do subliminally. So yeah, it doesn't take a whole lot, for a brain to become overwhelmed, for a brain to become hazed, fogged, things like that.
Well, and the ultimate goal is to basically control all of population. You know, the people at the top want you to want certain things, want you to purchase certain things, you know, want you to vote a certain way. And for people who go, oh my God, that really is conspiracy theory, they're going to control everyone in the world. Well, you know, when Obama was president, you know, he started the Nudge Squad and started the Brain Initiative. I mean, there was a lot of money thrown at investigating the brain, how it works, and how to control it. You know, and that wasn't the first wave of money, you know, pointed that direction. The first wave of money pointed that direction was MK Ultra in the 50s. You know, so I mean, this has been on the government agenda since at least 1950. So I mean, it's not a conspiracy theory. And the patents are out there, and you know, the patents are out there for microwave hearing. A lot of the Havana Syndrome victims, as well as targeted individuals, are hearing the voices of the people that are surveilling them, or hearing chat boxes, you know, that are making them think that they're hearing the voices of the people surveilling them. And Robert Duncan got pretty heavy into some of that, you know. But
yeah,
like I said, the only sure cure for that is going to finally get people in office that are going to enact the right investigations to where we'll, you know, have, you know, I hate to use the same term as they use in the UFO circles, but disclosure.
That's it. So. That's it. No. And that's just it. And I mean, I just popped up a thing on screen about AI and the fact of, even the fact of they're always listening. You don't need a microphone in your phone or in your TV, which yes, they're in your TV, people, feel free to look it up. Like Samsung said that in 2012, that your smart TV was listening to you in order to locally push ads for things local to your local television. But the idea that they don't even need to listen to you, just by what you look at, everything else, their algorithms quite literally already know what you would want to buy. And this goes back to something that I talk about regularly, which is many years ago, one of the conferences that I worked here in town was a white hat hacking conference, big security conference at UT. And speaking there was a former head of cybersecurity for the FBI. And this was 2012, 2013, something like that. Still in the days of flip phones, fully. Maybe you had a BlackBerry. But at that point, he said 5 years ago, so that would have been 28 timeline. He was talking in 2008 that the FBI with 85% accuracy could predict where you would be in 5 minutes. Just from the data on your phone. Just from pings as far as like you take the same route to work every day. We know where you stop for gas. We know how long you stop there. We know how frequently you stop there. We know how often you stop off and buy a taco. You know, and all of that was just from cell phone data. Now, that was 2008. That was far, far, far before we were being submitted to the online ads and cookies and things like that that we are as far as browsing on our phones now. So this idea of a predictive algorithm that already knows what you want to buy. My friend, how disturbing is the concept that because we are such creatures of habit, we are such creatures of pattern, that some of this may actively be AI driven.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of it probably is AI driven now. And it's funny you should mention
that. It just dawned on me, like, as we were talking in the last 5 minutes, which is why I popped this up. Just the idea that some of this technology, at least as far as who to target, how to target them, things like that, could totally be AI driven.
Well, and that's what a lot of the people that are being targeted with this are basically listening to a chat box, you know, that they're basically kind of hearing their thoughts and re-answering their thoughts.
Yeah. An echo chamber of themselves.
So exactly. And which will drive you equally crazy as to, even if it's not somebody with a completely different voice. Or the other thing they can do using AI is to morph your family members' voices.
And
so
Yeah. It's literally the idea that, you know, they are using your own worst thoughts against you.
You know, and that's kind of, we had noticed early on in this type of targeting that a lot of these targeted individuals would have really disturbing nightmares. I mean, they have a hard time sleeping anyway, because sleep deprivation is a big part of it.
Yep.
But what it is that with this type of technology, you can actually mine a person's thoughts during their REM state. So the technology allows you to get somebody's kind of more personal history while they're sleeping. So that's how they know what family members you're on good terms with, what family members you truly love, what family members you're having problems with, what your fears are, you know, because you tend to basically, most dreams are persecutory. So, you know, you tend to dream about what you fear, you know, being lost or being humiliated or being attacked or falling, you know, and once they know that, then they can use that against you, and they do. So,
yeah. And that's kind of the, once again, the horrible part, which is why we say regularly, Dr. Duncan said it regularly, know yourself, know your inner voice, because I've definitely been a lot more depressed and with a lot more negative self-talk inside my head than I ever typically am in the last couple months. And these other things have been happening. It's definitely perked my ears up. Let's just say that. So.
Well, and again, like I said, they can also, you know, anybody that's been in this fight, especially Duncan and I know I've had victims actually, you know, email me and say, well, you know, it's your voice I'm hearing, you know, when I go to bed at night, that's, you know, attacking me. They can mimic anybody's voice. They can mimic your mother, your father, your wife, your kids.
Oh, yeah.
And they certainly, there was a time period about 2 years ago where they were using Robert Duncan and my voice, you know, and to basically kind of help discredit us in the TI community, because all of a sudden you've got a handful of TIs going, well, it's Duncan that I'm hearing, or it's Hall that I'm hearing, you know, so.
Yeah.
But that one thing I want anybody that's listening that is being targeted, they can mimic any voice. So just because you're, you know, hearing what sounds like, you know, one of your parents, you know, that seems to be in on it, that's probably not the case.
I can tell you, right now, I literally just paid into a service for making little explainer videos, things like that, little like 2-minute TikToks. That kind of stuff. I paid into an AI service, doctor. And I trained an AI bot with my voice. It cost me $5.
Yeah.
And the thing's pretty damn accurate. And I gave it 25 clips that were between 45 seconds and 1 minute. From me interviewing somebody, just having a casual conversation like this, my normal meter, being excited at some points, being deep and contemplative at others, you know, very varied in the conversational tone. It was pretty impressive, man, for $5. I'll tell you that. And it only just started getting trained. So it doesn't take much. So if that's what's publicly available online for $5 a month, think about the technology that would be available in a contractor's computer using proprietary stuff, you know, using much higher technology than some online website to clone a voice. Even the idea of cloning thought. Even the idea of recording dreams, you know, and possibly being able to play them back. We know from recent experiments at MIT with people that have brain implant. Now, granted, people, when we say brain implant here, we aren't talking about like what we were talking about a minute ago, micro miniature implants, things like that. These were implants that these people volunteered to have put in.
Yeah, consensual.
And they were there to help remediate major seizure issues. Now, what they happened to be able to do was while they, and this was just an odd experiment that they were like, let's see what can happen. And they decided to, during a typical MRI, while they were checking things out and having them do other testing and seeing how their brain reacted to these other tests under MRI, they were like, hey, listen to this Pink Floyd song. And it was Wish You Were Here. So they recorded their brain with the MRI. As they were doing this and as they were listening to it. And then a week later, they had these same people come in whenever they came in for their typical test. And they were like, hey, while you're in there, you know, go ahead and start thinking about that Pink Floyd song that we played for you. And they were able to, amongst the memories recorded from people as they thought about it, able to recreate the song. Now, it doesn't sound like a phonographic copy, you know, it sounds garbled and weird. But the fact that they were able to do that from people's memories, the fact that they were able to watch their memory form, basically, you know, and record them as it happened, and then have them come back and think about it and record it and reassemble that from their thoughts. That's pretty major. And goes a long way to some of the technologies that we're talking about, some of the means that we're talking about, to hijack brainwaves, to be able to record brainwaves, to be able to even as they've already discovered, to actively talk with dreamers, you know, to have people answer questions in their dreams.
Well, they've already figured out how to target dreams with commercials. That's going to be the next forefront of marketing to you. Is going to, they're going to market in your dreams, which is interesting because you know
all the time.
Well, you know, and that's the interesting thing is what is that going to do to humanity? Obviously, we were constructed with the idea that eventually your brain has downtime. You know, at least that's my firm belief. Now, if your brain is constantly being stimulated, even when you're asleep, you know, what is that going to do to us as, you know, as a species? And I mean, I don't think it can be good.
It's definitely not good. And, you know, one of the things that we talked about the last couple times we've had you on, is the study that was done by the National Institute of Health, right as the down curve of the pandemic happened, where, it basically showed that there was hypothalamal damage or hippocampal damage,
hippocampal damage.
From negative news cycles, things like that. People who are inundated with negativity all the time. And it was interesting to see that specifically. And then also the fact that, as you revealed, that there was also a study done that there was hippocampal bruising from COVID shots, from some COVID vaccine recipients.
Yeah, that's because the spike protein. The spike protein, and they think the spike protein on the COVID virus was actually designed specifically to attack the hippocampus. So, I mean, and you're right. I mean, the part of the brain initiative under Obama and before is they discovered that the part of the brain that needs to be targeted to control people really is the hippocampus. Your hippocampus is what determines your historical context of right and wrong, your historical context of what is dangerous or not. That's dangerous.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. So it's the soft velvet glove that surrounds your amygdala, and the amygdala is that reptilian brain of fight or flight panic response. You know, and I talk about it regularly whenever I'm on shows, doctor, talking about binaural beat music, things like that. Like, it's not necessarily a horrible thing, you know, like my anxiety, for instance. Like, I went to a panic doctor for a little while talking about things, and he came to a great point of understanding. I came to a great point of understanding of this is just remnant of. Yeah, when we lived and when the dark came, we were food, you know? That's what anxiety is. It's preparation for things that you can't predict. And the problem is that reptilian brain can be hijacked. And if what's securing you and what's making you feel secure, that hippocampus that's there, that's that check mechanism between your logical, rational brain and the reptilian brain of fear and panic that is the amygdala, when that's damaged, then yeah, you're not going to be able to properly process information. You're not going to be able to step outside of that fear envelope necessarily or see things with a clear lens. And I'll pop that up on screen. Once again, people, I'll read it out loud for those of you who are only listening. This is from the National Institute of Health. The functional and structural changes of the hippocampus of COVID-19 patients can explain neuronal degeneration and reduced neurogenesis in the human hippocampus. This will open a window to explain memory and cognitive dysfunctions in, quote, long COVID through the resultant loss of hippocampal neurogenesis. Actual stuff, like the virus itself was designed to attack your brain and to do that. And that's fascinating to see. And when you marry that with let's lock everybody inside for a year and a half and just pump them full of fear news 24/7, pump them full of fear statistics 24/7, you know, between the two of them, the likelihood of anybody coming out without some sort of muddied water that they're looking through in life is pretty nil, you know?
Well, that was also the reason for the mRNA virus. You're right. You know, you're going to have the people who caught COVID, the virus that produced the spike protein.
Yeah.
From it. And you're going to have the shutdowns that actually put everybody in a victim mindset, uh-huh. you know, and pull the kids out of school yeah. and desocialized everyone. But at the same time, they were really pushing that mRNA-based vaccine, because the way that works is your body takes that mRNA and you produce the spike protein on your own. So that kind of covered their bases as far as, well, what do we do with the people who don't catch? What do we do with the people who don't catch the virus? Well, we give them a vaccine that'll make them produce the spike protein. So, yeah. I mean, you know, that way you get it in everyone.
It's an interesting triumvirate there, you know, amongst things. And once again, I'd love to say that there isn't an actual study from the National Institute of Health that shows this. I'd love to say that there isn't an actual study from the National Institute of Health talking about the effects of negative news cycles on the brain. I'm not saying that these things were all designed together. I'm just saying that that is a wild confluence of things that all come together. And when you look at the way that the world has shaken out after, when you look at the mass confusion in places all over the place, whenever you look at even the way that people take in data now, the way that people take in and ingest news and other stuff, if they even choose to anymore.
Well, do you remember when we were doing some of the early shows right after COVID hit? You couldn't even get anybody in the government to just admit that it came out of that lab in Wuhan.
Yeah.
You know, even in the medical community and the pharmacist community, I mean, I had, you know, doctors that are like, well, there's no evidence that it really came out of that lab. And I'm like, that COVID virus variant came from one species of bat that comes from one place in China, you know, and they were using that bat to do research in the Wuhan lab.
Yeah.
They did. They checked the wet markets. Initially, remember, they were trying to say it was from somebody eating bat soup.
It was from a pangolin originally.
Yeah, and then there was the pangolin.
Yeah,
you know, theory. But I mean, it would be kind of like in medicine. Most doctors go by a theory of, if you're in a stable full of horse shit, look for horses, not zebras. You know, so you know you don't go to Chick-fil-A to get a Big Mac. So if what you see, if the virus is coming from a lab where they had the bats to do the research, and you know they were doing the research, and we knew the money was going there, I don't know why it took so long for people to come around and just saying whether it was accidental or intentionally released, which I think it was. The political correct answer is that it was an accidental release. But yeah. my personal thought is that was a beta test to see how quickly they could disseminate a disastrous virus globally. Mm. And the intent wasn't to kill a bunch of people with the COVID, but the intent with the next one is going to be.
Well, and you know, like even whenever you look at the Wuhan lab, things like that was, it was a huge international effort. We put a lot of money into the Wuhan lab. We actually stopped our gain of function and switched everything over to there. That came out in the COVID panel. And if you're looking for that, folks, just so you know, feel free to visit curiousrealm.com/videos. That is where you can find not only our videos from our channel and all of our guest channels, but right there underneath ours is a UFO UAP declassified government panel. And inside of that, you will find, there it is right there. You can see the COVID on it. The House Select Coronavirus Committee holds a hearing on the investigation of the origin of a cover-up. And that they have intelligence officials in there talking about it. I remember when France left the Wuhan lab, because once again, it was an international consortium lab, and France left and went to the UN and was like, hey, we're pulling our funding and we're leaving? Because they were hugely involved with the building of it and everything else. And they were like, looks kind of like China is trying to build ethno-specific viruses, so we're out of here. And that came up in the panel, all kinds of things. So you can actually find that, and most of what we're talking about, folks, right there in that coronavirus panel, that's right there on curiousrealm.com/videos. It's one of those I'd love to say it's not a thing. I'd love to say it's not out there, but it is. And there are tons of things that line up in the world for us to be literally hijacked in our brains. And when you start adding other technologies on top of what we're already inundated with, our mobile devices, with news things popping up in our feed, with, you know, just the vehement anger on social media and the echo chamber that is, stuff like that. We're constantly in a fight or flight mode, you know? We're always like that. So you add these other things on top of it, and it only compounds the situation, you know? And once again, like we were saying with our guest last time when you were on, that those things make machines spike in a very certain way that go, hey, look at this juicy target.
Yep.
Look at this.
You know, and
that's kind of control.
And that's the scary thing is, you know, now talking about, you know, we were talking about implants earlier. Well, it doesn't have to be a giant Verichip, or it doesn't even have to be nanotechnology. If it's a viral particle, then you're going to be victimized. I mean, there's very few ways to prevent it, you know, and especially if they do it again, like they did with COVID, where they convince a great majority of the population to take a vaccine that's an mRNA-based vaccine, you know, because that's going to cause your body to produce the exact particle that they want produced.
Fascinating stuff, man. I love our conversations, Doctor. Thank you so much for the time. It's always great. Before we let you go, where can people go to find help? That's always the question that comes whenever you're on, is where can I go to find help? What can I do? What can I do for my family member that's suffering from being a targeted individual? What can folks do, Doctor?
Well, there's Freedom from Covert Surveillance and Harassment that is still around. There's some other targeting group, Target Justice. If you Google targeted individual, you'll find there is a lot of community help out there. I keep a Facebook page that is called Guinea Pigs, Technology of Control for myself. Now, I'm pretty well inundated with messages. I mean, some of them I get back to, some of them I don't get a chance to, but I mean, you're always, you know, welcome to try to find me there or message me there. But do find help, and I mean, talk to people that have gone through it, because the worst thing you can do is really browbeat your family if they're not believing you.
But yeah,
that used to be the case almost all the time. Thank God here more recently it's been the other way around. It's been people calling, getting a hold of me saying, you know, we've heard your shows. We did look into it. You know, our son or our daughter or my wife or my husband is complaining about just this exact issue. And, you know, and some of them, you know, if you're around a targeted individual long enough, you'll see that, you know, they're having twitches when they shouldn't be having twitches. And, they're hearing things every now and again. Even someone near a targeted individual can hear what they're hearing. So, because it's meant to kind of isolate that person, but it doesn't always work that way. So, yeah. I mean, it's at least more and more family members are starting to actually look for answers and help their family members rather than, you know, condemn them. So,
yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. That's just it. It takes a heart and soul of empathy, folks, to understand what somebody's going through with this. The fact that they are a victim of something that they themselves cannot explain. And they may have gone down a deep and dark rabbit hole of information sometimes that can be very thick and nebulous if you're not aware of things.
Much of
what's out there in some of those communities is horrifying misinformation. Just as somebody who like works daily in the world of RF technology, things like that. It's one of those, like, that's not how that works.
As the targeted individual, also put yourself in your family member's shoes too. You know, we have been, you know, socialized for 100 years now or longer to basically think if you're hearing something that the rest of us can't hear, then you're crazy.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that's still the whole basis of psychiatry, you know? So, you know, if you're displaying something or voicing something that isn't part of my reality, then it's a disorder.
Yeah.
So, and that is the whole basis of American psychiatry. So, just put yourself in their shoes and realize that they're not able to hear what you hear.
Yeah.
And just because they don't necessarily believe you doesn't mean they're in on it or part of it.
That's right. That's right. Or that they don't love you or that they aren't there to support you come time for that. So thank you so much once again for your time. For
all right.
Candid.
Great to be here.
On this always, Doctor. I appreciate your friendship on and off the show. So hold the line real quick. Well, go ahead.
Always love to be on the show, Chris.
Thanks, man. I appreciate it.
Even when you make me follow up something as hard as demonic body snatcher.
Oh, man. I am telling you right now, the work of Nathaniel Gillis, you will be hearing that on major shows in the next couple years, folks. Guaranteed. 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 It's amazing. Thank you, as always, Doctor. Hold the line real quick while we close things out with the audience. While you are online, find your copy of Guinea Pigs, Technologies of Control, as well as A New Breed, Satellite Terrorism in America. Boy, I'm fumbling at the end. Make sure to stop on by Curious Realm. Curious Realm is where you can like, follow, subscribe. That's where you can find all of our declassified documents in the Curious Realm vault. Just go to curiousrealm.com/knowledge and you can find that. There's tons of declassified stuff in there. A lot of the technology that we talked about tonight is right there in the declassified government programs section. Once again, the videos that we were talking about tonight, the government panels are right there on curiousrealm.com/videos, where you can find all of our guests' videos as well as ours. You can like and follow and subscribe to the channels right there. And of course, this holiday season, for yourself or your friend or your family member who is an investigator out in the field doing investigation in the world of paranormal research, UFOs, cryptids, things like that, make sure to stop on by Curious Research and get your copy of the Curious Research Field Observation and Encounter Log. It is your way to be able to garner your data in the field as it's happening in real time in a scientific way and have everything ready to shake hands with science come that day, which is rapidly approaching. So thank you so much, everybody, for your time tonight. Thank you so much for your open hearts, your open minds. That is what makes the conversation. And without the conversation, humanity does not march forward. So remember, take care of yourselves. Take care of each other in this new year. And stay curious. We'll talk to you soon. Bye-bye.
Thank you for tuning into this episode of The Curious Realm. Stay tuned for more guests, forbidden topics, and hidden truths. Follow us on social media by searching Curious Realm. To download the official Curious Realm app and view the Knowledge Vault, or become a sponsor of Curious Realm, visit our website at CuriousRealm.com. Curious Realm is available on your favorite podcast and video services. CuriousRealm.com, as well as KGRA Radio, APR TV, and the official Curious Realm app for Roku devices. Curious Realm is a proud member of the Ground Zero Media and Aftermath Media family of podcasts. For more great shows and members-only content, visit aftermath.media today. Thanks for listening. Stay curious. And remember, the other side is always watching.